Welcome back to Season 2 of Cowboy Cartel, the podcast that delves into all things hats, boots, and everything Western related. We're truly grateful for the continued support from American Hat Company and Joby's Hats. American Hat Company, proud to be an American, proud to wear an American. American Hat is the official hat of Cowboy Cartel. And if you're looking for the perfect fit, look no further than Joby's Hats, our official hat shaper. Visit them in Fort Worth, Texas, or check them out online at jobyshats.com. But that's not all. We have some exciting news for all you Cowboy Cartel fans. Don't forget to check out our brand new American-made t-shirt line, available now at cowboycartelgroup.com. And for those hat enthusiasts, we've got some fantastic hat patches to add a touch of style to your favorite lid. So, grab your hats, put on your boots, and let's dive into another thrilling episode of Cowboy Cartel, the podcast, where we explore the captivating world of all things hats, boots, and Western culture.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us. This is Season 2, Podcast 4, I believe. With us today is, we got a really special guest today. It's not something we usually focus on, and it's going to be interesting. So today we've got ranch manager, horseman, polo player, collector, writer, leather craftsman, and all-around artist, Jerry Gazelle. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Thanks for taking the time to come see us today and be on the show. So we want to talk about a few things. Right off the bat, if you don't know, Jerry's got a podcast, and recently you spoke about an injury you had. You broke your arm and required surgery, but I mean, when I met you today, there's no cast. I don't know what's going on there, man.
Breaking my arm, it was kind of a freak deal. And I talked about it briefly in my podcast. I tried to start my air compressor, and when I pulled the cord to start it, the cord broke and my arm swung back and hit a post and ended up breaking the outside bone, the ulna. And they had to basically put it back together with the plate and six screws. And they did that. It's been, it's been almost 2 weeks, I guess, 10 days since I did that. And it was just a freak accident. I mean, I wish it could have been something more exciting, but it wasn't very exciting, but still happened. But
when I told my wife that you'd broken your arm, she said, "How?" And I told her the story that you relayed on your podcast, and I think she cringed a little bit. Yeah. It sounds painful.
It was one of those things that I think people thought it should have hurt worse than it did, but I knew right away that I broke it. And cause I have broken bones before, but it probably sounded worse than it actually felt, but I did know that it was broken, and it ended up being a little bit more broken than we thought it was by the time they did the x-rays. So, but it could always be worse.
Did it make a crunch? Did you hear the sound?
No, when I was opening and closing my fist, I could feel and hear the clicking of the pieces of bone moving back and forth. And so I knew,
oh man,
you know, you could just feel that clicking in there, you know, basically that the break was just hitting against itself. And so it was, but I, you know, they always say if you break something, you go numb or you don't feel your hand or something, but I could still feel every single thing that was there. And I could feel those pieces of bone moving. So, and there was a piece of bone in between the break that was not completely loose, but there was a piece in there that could easily have come loose, and they would have had to have tried to fish that piece back between the breaks. So luckily it didn't come. I think if I would have tried to do more instead of going straight to the doctor, that piece of bone probably would have moved out of there. So I just jumped in the pickup and drove to the doctor. So it's like any other day, I guess, but it was amazing. Cause I broke it on a Tuesday, went to my orthopedic surgeon on Wednesday and they did surgery Thursday morning. So it was just a matter of a couple of days, you know, and it was, you know, they had me put back together. So
it's almost unheard of. I tell a story about medical care in other countries, because I've had some amazing stories like that where, you know, I got sick middle of the night. I was in a hotel, in a country that I didn't speak the language. I went to the hotel lobby and I said, I need a doctor. I think it was 45 minutes. In the 45 minute period of time, I went to the doctor's office, got diagnosed, got medicine, and was back at the hotel. Yeah. So, and all for $65. So
yeah, it's pretty amazing. I've spoke about it a little bit. It's the idea that my doctors are also, for lack of a better description, they're cowboys. You know, the one doctor is calf roper, and I actually broke horses for him when I first moved to San Angelo. And so they have, you know, there's something special about, they know what we do and they know what we want to be doing and that we can't be down for, you know, for long periods of time. Obviously, if it was a worse injury, there would have, you know, it would have been a little bit different, but it wasn't that big of a deal. And they knew that, you know, I needed to be back to ranching. You know, I had a job to do. So it, you know, the time that they spent putting me back together was so brief, you know, and so I'm pretty grateful to have doctors that kind of understand our culture, you know, the ranching heritage. And so that, I think that played a big part in getting me put back together that fast.
Well, you look like you're pretty mobile with it. No cast, like we said, and you know, you shook my hand, you leaned on it. So you're not having a tremendous amount of pain.
There's a little bit of stiffness. And it's funny because I tell the story that, you know, I broke it on Tuesday, had surgery on Thursday, and I showed a horse and roped on Saturday. And people still have a hard time believing that, but I have a hard, so roping wasn't hard for me, but tucking my shirt in is, or brushing my teeth, you know, it's all about the angle. And I mean, obviously I'm not going to go pick up things that are heavy, you know, but it's amazing some of the things I can do. And then some of the simplest things I struggle with, you know, just because I can't rotate my arm until it's healed. But basically they just made an incision about 7 inches long and put that plate and screws in there and then put sutures in there. It's one of those things that, you know, people don't, if they didn't know I had a broken arm, they wouldn't know I had a broken arm. So it's kind of mind blowing, you know, anymore that they don't, you know, you hardly ever see anybody with a cast on their arm anymore, which I'm thankful for that, because I wouldn't be able to be doing much of anything if they'd put a cast on me. So I'd rather have surgery and get back to work than not have surgery and not be able to do everything. So I'll do that any time I break a bone. So,
well, you forgot one part of that story. It was, you won a buckle on Saturday.
Yeah. So it was one of those, and I talked about it obviously in my podcast, but I had made the joke that, wouldn't it be funny if I broke my arm on a Tuesday, had surgery on a Thursday, and won a buckle on the Saturday? And because I shouldn't have shown, I shouldn't have, and I, you know, we'll talk a little bit about that, about the futurity on that Friday, but it was this whole idea, and people said, oh, you willed it to happen. And I kind of was half serious about it, but I also made the point that if I hadn't won a buckle on Saturday, I would have felt kind of dumb for doing all of it. So I was really, you know, I was very focused on, okay, I need to make a really good run. I need to rope my cow. I need to do everything the best that I've done all year, because I have to, you know, if I'm going to do this with a broken arm and make a point that I can do this with a broken arm, then I better do the best I can that day. And so it all worked out. And, you know, it was one of those, after I made my run, in that class, I didn't want to assume that I won the class, but I had a pretty good feeling that I had won the class. And it was a really, but I didn't want to didn't want to think I did until I knew for sure that I, when I looked at the score sheets. And so it was kind of one of those things that it needed to happen. And I'm grateful that it happened the way it did, because I had had this vision in my head of what I would talk about from breaking my arm to winning that buckle. And it gave me, you know, it gave me everything to make that podcast when I talked about it. And if I hadn't have done that, we wouldn't be talking about it. I'd be embarrassed and I'd be a little bit ashamed, you know, so it all kind of worked out, you know. I think that was more the power of positive thinking, you know, when it came to that. And I kind of, I mean, I do think in some way I willed it to happen. So, and I'm glad it did.
So, yeah. So you showed a horse on Saturday, but you actually missed the main event on a Friday.
Yeah. So a little bit there was the horse that I show, Miss Jones. I had bought her as a yearling at a horse sale in Leveland, Texas, and they have a futurity for those yearlings that you buy. They're eligible to show in a futurity as 3-year-olds. And that was my goal with her when I bought her, was, you know, I would train her 2-year-old year, start showing her 3-year-old year, and then show her in the Clovis futurity on that Friday. And I'd worked all year to get to that point. And it's one of those, you know, when I talk about things that you will to happen, I'd had this strange premonition that I was going to break my arm, but I was thinking I was going to break my arm the week before I showed in Amarillo. And I joked about it a little bit, but sometimes I think you know, it's these premonitions, so to speak. So when I broke my arm on that Tuesday, the first thing I thought of was, I'm not going to be able to show. I didn't think I'd be able to show Friday or Saturday, but Friday was the most important thing because it was that futurity. And I just knew that, you know, even with having surgery on Thursday, there was no way I could show on that Friday. For one, I just couldn't, there would have been no way I could have been ready to show. Even if I was capable of showing, I wasn't going to be ready to show. But it was, that was a huge letdown, because that was the one thing that I was really looking forward to, was being able to take her back to that futurity and show her. And, you know, it was a disappointment, but so it just made it that much more important to show on that Saturday. You know, you can't cry over spilled milk. So it's one of those things that, yeah, you know, it happened and it was a huge disappointment, but, you know, we can't win them all, you know.
So, but that's not... That's not the end of the road there for Miss Jones, though. Mm-hmm. So she missed this futurity. She obviously can't go to the next one, but she has a long career.
Yeah,
ahead
of her. So she's getting a little vacation right now. After I showed her on that Saturday, you know, I decided, you know, she deserved a break. She had a pretty busy summer. Like we talked earlier, since June, she had made 22 runs. And because I always show her twice at every horse show. And then I got to show her a third time at a few of these other horse shows. So she worked hard this summer and she came a long way. And so the future's bright for her. She's just a 3-year-old. So her 4-year-old year, we're already qualified for the RHA finals in Abilene in May. But I'll continue to keep showing her, and hopefully I'd like to get her into some NRCHA shows later in this coming year, and kind of step up her game. Because if I step up her game, then I got to step up my game, and I'll learn more and be able to improve upon what I'm learning and what I'm trying to do with her, you know, as a show horse. But I usually plan, after I show a young horse in Abilene their 4-year-old year, I usually try to sell them and then bring up, you know, another horse. But I've decided that I'm just going to keep her and just keep showing her as long as I can, because I think I need to see how far I can take one, because I've never actually, you know, taken a horse past their 4-year-old year. So it's going to be something new for me, but it's going to give me a lot of, I'm going to learn a lot by keeping her and seeing how far I can take her in her career and mine.
So why is that? Why would you sell them at 4 years old? Is that part of horse training that at this point maybe they're ready to be sold and for a new owner, or is that?
So for me, it's always been, I like training young horses. I like breaking two-year-olds, and then I like getting them to a certain point and then selling them so someone else can take them and finish them, you know, better trainers, better horsemen, and go on to a bigger career outside of what I'm capable of doing, because I'm not a full-time horse trainer. I've got, you know, a ranch to take care of, so I can't spend all my time training horses. And at one point, they need that. They need to go on for their careers. They need to go on to full-time trainers and go into like a real full-time horse show career or whatever career they go into. But, and I get bored, you know, honestly, I like bringing those young horses on. And so, you know, for me, it's a matter of at their four-year-old year, I sell them and I go buy another one, or I've got my other ones coming up behind them, and it keeps me fresh with things. And I, you know, there's always something exciting about starting a new one, but, and, you know, I try to make a living as well. But with her, I don't think I can't stand the thought of selling her. You know, I've gotten real attached to her because she was kind of an interesting, you know, there's a lot of dynamic to her. And at this point, you know, I've kind of grown really attached to her. And usually I love all my horses, but I've never had a problem with selling them and moving them on to another career. But with her, I don't think, and she takes a certain kind of person to be around her. She's a little quirky, and I'm pretty protective of her. And I've tried to get her over some of her quirkiness, but she's always going to have it. And so I just assume, you know, take care of her myself and deal with that quirkiness and see how far I can take her. So we'll see anyway. So,
so she's made appearances on both your TikTok and your Instagram. Mm-hmm. Your TikTok is more focused on your horse training and your bits and, mm-hmm. And your tack, right? Mm-hmm. And then your Instagram is more of an artistic expression. And there you go into pretty long format writing, especially for Instagram. So what kind of led to you kind of separating those two platforms? And then on a follow-up for that, your Instagram has now kind of been the basis that's become your podcast.
Mm-hmm. There, so with the two platforms, it, and I've mentioned it before, is I have a lot of the same followers on both platforms. And so for me to think that somebody would go look at something I have on Instagram and then go to TikTok and see the exact same thing, well, then there's no need for both platforms. And so I found a way, and it all kind of just happened naturally. You know, it's not like I intended to keep them separate, but I found that the audience and the platform on TikTok works better for talking about my bridles, talking about my ideas on training horses. Whereas Instagram, I've put there's a little bit deeper element to the Instagram. And I feel that Instagram works well for, you know, my writing, for some of the deeper dives on intellectualism, for lack of a better description. But TikTok, when I started talking more about my bridles, I could see how that audience developed and how different the audience is. You know, if they're different followers, the audience is looking for that information on, you know, my ideas on bridles or training horses. Whereas my audience on Instagram, you know, knows that side of me. So they want to see the other side. They want to see, you know, when I'm telling a story, or if I'm writing about something and exposing some vulnerabilities or life lessons. And it's so easy to apply those lessons to our culture with horses. You know, they seem to just work well together. And so it just started taking, both of them took on their own identities, and it's not hard to draw a line between the two. It's not like I have to work really hard to talk about something on TikTok and then try to separate from what I talk about on Instagram. It's just really easy for me to keep them both completely separate.
I mean, that's an interesting idea, especially now when you have a lot of TikTok stars and these people who are out there specifically to maximize the influence. And so I'm guilty of this too. I post the same things on TikTok and Instagram gets pushed to Facebook because I need the most reach that I can get.
And I try to keep things as real and as organic as I can on both platforms. Obviously with TikTok, you know, I have to set up my phone and then I kind of have an idea what I'm going to talk about. And then I try to, you know, obviously I'm not using photos on TikTok. So there's not this idea that the image needs to connect to the words. It's basically I'm showing what I'm talking about or I'm explaining what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. With Instagram, I'm really picky about, you know, when I'm writing something, I want the image to have a connection to the words that I'm writing. And sometimes that's hard to do, but I might spend an hour trying to find a photo that can relate to what I'm trying to convey in the words that I'm writing. And so every once in a while, I might have to set up and take a picture of myself, which is, I don't like to do. Really, I don't like to do it at all, but sometimes I have to, because I have this image of what I want. And sometimes it just happens perfectly. Even if I take a screenshot from a video that I'm doing, it somehow works. And so, but I never intended, you know, with either platform to influence. It wasn't about being an influencer. It wasn't about trying to shape the way people think about things. It was just me talking. And the more I did it, the easier it became. But I also realized that the more I, especially with Instagram, the more I do it, the more people are relating to what I have to say. And when I get feedback from people, I've started to realize, wow, people actually do read this stuff. They read it. They read every word of what I'm writing, and they are finding meaning in what I'm writing. And that was never my intention, but now it's become where I'm very, when I do write something, I write it because it's in my head and I need to write it or I need to share it. But I also understand that people are reading what I'm writing. So I'm very aware that whatever I put out there has to have meaning because it's affecting somebody somewhere, you know, or affecting a lot of people. And so I've become very, very aware of what I share on Instagram in the sense that if it helps somebody or if it inspires somebody, that's great. I hate using the word influence because it's dangerous, especially with social media, you know, because influencer can mean a lot of different things. And I get teased about it. You know, some of my good friends will tease me about being an influencer. And I always, no, I'm not an influencer. And I don't want it to appear that way because there's a little bit of a, you know, negative connotation with the word influencer, because I'm not doing it for fashion or anything like that. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I don't want to influence the way people think, but I want to inspire them to think, if that makes any sense. So
it does, but you know, you say you're not into fashion. You've got a pretty good fashion style, man. I've seen your jackets. That's a type 2, you know, denim, you know, style. That's a classic style.
Yeah.
And you know, you wear great boots, you wear great hats. So, I mean, you've got a style and it's punchy.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody yesterday about, you know, over the years, you know, my aesthetic probably fluctuated, but I was always the same person, no matter if I was wearing a t-shirt or if I was wearing a, you know, long sleeve panhandle shirt or Wrangler shirt, whatever it was. But I joked also about the fact that if you go into my closet now, I have blue shirts and then I have denim shirts. I don't have any, there's nothing else. So it's the same outfit every day, just clean, you know, or not clean, but it's the thing about what I tell people about my style is the less I try to have fashion style or fashion sense, the more it's authentic. And I can pick up on that from just being around different people, you know, and if you embrace your authentic style, it becomes a style, so to speak. And then people want to emulate that. And then I have, I have these ideas about something that I do want, but I want it to be unique or unique to me, you know, like my blue boots, you know, which seem to create, they've created a lot of conversations, you know, but I didn't design those boots with the idea to shock people. I had this idea of what I wanted that boot to look like, and it was spot on when they were built, but I didn't, and I don't always wear them because people recognize my boots before they recognize me. But I the reason I don't always wear them is because I'm not trying to make a point of like, you know, you need to wear a pair of baby blue, you know, cowboy boots. It was just something that I feel when I put them on, they're me. They're unique to me. They're part of my personality, part of my personal style. But it's not a style that I'm trying to make, because you don't want everybody looking like you. I'm very, very conscious about the idea that I don't want 15 other guys wearing my same boot. And that tends to be a trap that a lot of people fall in, no matter what industry you're in. But in the cowboy world, you know, there is a lot of this, you know, so-and-so wears that particular style, I want to look just like him. So, yeah.
Keith Maddox was a huge inspiration in my life. He was probably the most positive person that I ever met. When we were ever faced with a challenge and anything, he would say, "Don't worry about it, ain't nothing but a thing." We're wanting to keep his memory and his legacy alive, so that's what that stands for. Positive times, we choose to look at everything that we do through a positive lens, not a negative lens.
American Hat Company, proud to be an American, proud to wear an American.
Speaking of your blue boots, if you guys haven't seen these, and if you're just listening to the audio portion of this, check out Jerry's Instagram, which is just at
Jerry Gazelle. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or I'm gonna put a picture of it up here. Actually, are your boots even on your Instagram? I think they're all over Letty's.
So I there's probably pictures of me wearing them on my Instagram, but ML Letty. There's a lot of pictures of me with the blue boots. I think the first time we photographed that pair of boots was we were in Turkey, Texas at the Bob Wills Festival. And that was the first time that we took some photographs and video of them when I wore them. And that was the first day that I actually put them on. Well, I tried them on when I picked them up, but that was the first day that I actually wore those boots. And so I broke them in while we were up there in Turkey. But there's a lot of... They've put a lot of pictures of them up on their Instagram account.
Yeah, so. you're featured on their Instagram quite often, and that's kind of how this all started. Funny story is that's how I found you. That's how I started listening to your podcast is new. There's a lot to unpack here. So I had seen you on Instagram before, and I don't know if I was following you yet, but I saw the ML Letty advertising because I'd recently been interested personally in ML Letty. Mm-hmm. I went down to their Stockyard store for the first time, and I looked at their boots, and I was kind of blown away with their production boots. And I had to come back and do more research about Letty, and I actually ordered a pair of Letty's on eBay just to try them out, mm-hmm. to see, you know, are these comfortable? And turned out that they were Letty Vaqueros, which are Mexican-made boots. Mm-hmm. Yes, I accidentally bought a pair of Mexican-made boots, but they are fantastic.
Those boots are better than what people expect when they do get them. They're surprised at the quality of them. And I actually don't have a pair of those, but I've seen them, and everybody that wears them loves them. They're surprised by how well-made they are.
I have a hard time with Mexican-made boots from an American company because they're not usually any good. These things are fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the softest leather. They're super comfortable. You know, the attention to detail and they're just next level for a decent price, you know.
And they're affordable.
Yeah. So that was my first introduction to Leti, and that's what led me to you. I said, I recognize that name when I you know, you hover over it and it pops up who's tagged in it. And I said, I recognize that name. I know this guy. So that's how I started kind of following you and kind of seeing your journey and learning more about you. And then we started talking on Instagram, and just so happens I'm in town this week and you're in town this week because you're down.
Just came to watch the fraternity, the NCHA fraternity that's going on right now. And so it was perfect timing, you know, that you're here and I'm here and we could do that. So it actually, the universe once again worked in our favor. So yeah, I give a lot of credit to the universe. So always.
It worked out pretty good. Mm. And we're so happy that it did. So I guess it's a good time to talk about your love of Leti boots, because you're a collector and you've collected boots in the past, and let's tell me a little bit about that.
So I've always loved handmade boots, and I've worn a lot of handmade boots by makers that work out of their one man shop, and I appreciate every boot maker. It's hard for me to speak about one particular maker, because I don't want people to think that I'm taking away from other boots that I've worn by other makers. But ML Leti, the reason I like ML Leti boots so much is because they're still family owned. The boots are still made, in San Angelo. They're over 100-year-old boot company. I took a chance, and when I ordered my first pair, you know, I was very picky about what I wanted in that boot, and I explained it to them, and they kind of understood what I wanted in that boot, what I wanted it to look like, what I wanted it to ride like when I was in the saddle. So the first pair they made me, they didn't get just right, that happens, you know, that's why, you know, they always, you know, when you go in there and you order your first pair of boots, they try to get you to kind of slow down on all of the custom things that you want, because maybe that first pair they build you, you know, there's always that chance that they don't fit just right, or you're not exactly happy with it, but they know how to get it right on your second pair. Not saying that that's the case, but I remember they said, take them home, ride in them for a day. If you don't like them, bring them back. We'll sell the boot. We'll build you a new one. And that was mind blowing to me, because I did. I took them home and I rode in them one day, all day, because I thought, well, I'm going to give them an entire day to see if I'm happy with them. And they were just a little bit, and it was just a minor thing. It wasn't like some disastrous miss on building them. I took them back and they said, no problem. There was no hesitation. They took that boot back and they sent it actually from Angelo. They sent it up here to the stockyard store and they sold them, but they built me the second pair, and they knew what they had to get right. And they got it spot on. And so that made me really loyal to them, in the sense that they honored, you know, they honored that boot. And then when I ordered another pair from them, you know, I had this idea of what I wanted in my second pair of boots. And once again, I said, I'm looking for this color green. And, you know, the one lady listened to me that was working in the back, and she said, I've got this green leather. She brought it out. I was like, perfect. So that pair of boots, one of the most comfortable pair of boots I've ever worn. And so then when I had the idea for building the blue boots, I had this vision in my head of this blue that I wanted and what I wanted the boot to look like. I wanted it to look like an old vintage singing cowboy boot, but I wanted it to also be a cowboy's boot. You know, I wanted the tall riding heel. I liked the underslung heels and I liked the really pointed toe, but I wanted this blue. And so when I went back into the store, you know, and I explained again, like, I'm looking for this blue. And she brought out this baby blue, and it was the perfect baby blue. And I was blown away. And of course it was the perfect piece of leather for building, you know, the Vamps. And then we went with a dark blue, almost midnight blue, top, and then an upside down stitch pattern. But you know, it was it that pair was almost 2 years to build because of COVID and everything else, in which their boots, they're pretty good about. If they tell you a year, you'll probably get them in 11 months, you know, but they're handmade. You know, that's what people don't understand. You can watch that boot be made in the store in San Angelo. And I like that idea. And I like that you can still talk to the family, you know, that owns ML Eddy boots. And so the blue boot, you know, when they sent me a picture of them, Jason McClellan that works there in Angelo at the shop, he sent me a picture of them when they were done, and I was blown away. I couldn't believe they were perfect. And when I tried them on, when I went into the store to pick them up and I pulled those boots on, it was mind blowing because we had narrowed the toe up drastically from my other pair. So there's always that question if they're still going to fit right, but they knew how to adjust with the last to make them fit right. And they were spot on. And the heel was perfect. You know, it's not a heel that they normally do. No one wants that 2-inch underslung heel on a boot.
It's tall.
And I love that old style of heel, like on the old Paul Bond boots. You know, they had that 2.25 underslung heel, and that's what I wanted. That was going to make that boot look just right with that pointed toe, with that underslung heel, the tall tops, and just the blue. You know, they couldn't have been any more perfect. And I didn't build that boot to get a reaction out of people. It wasn't that I was trying to shock people with this bright baby blue boot. It's what I wanted. It fit my style. It was vintage, but also contemporary, and it seems to, you know, the reactions for that boot have been really, really funny, but also incredible. You know, I've had probably 90% positive feedback on those boots. And then you get that 10%, you know, where people are like, oh, those things are absurd. You know, they're ridiculous, you know, but you know, everybody, you know, there's a boot for everybody. So, but.
And you wear those and work in those.
I work in them. Mm-hmm. And I was real protective of them when I first got them. I would just show in them. I showed in them at Abilene this year at the RHA finals. And of course, somebody over the, you know, when I was showing my horse, you know, somebody said that they mentioned my bright blue boots, you know, so you could see them in the arena as I showed. And I'd only showed in them, but now I've went ahead and it's, you know, I don't believe in saving a boot as a dress boot and a boot for a work boot. So they're being worked in now. I cowboy in them, and because they got to hold up, you know, and you know, you can say a boot will last forever if you don't ever wear it. But if you wear it every day and you cowboy in it and it lasts forever, then there's something to be said for that. So.
Well, your last or your older pair of boots from Letty, it's on their Instagram as well. Mm-hmm. And it's rough. It's, yeah.
That pair, they were actually really curious when they built that pair with the olive green bottoms, and they look black now. That green has gotten really dark just from being used. But those boots are 4 years old, and I've worn the hell out of them. And there's no holes, there's no cracks, there's no breakdown of that boot. And they've been wet, they've been abused, you know, and I do take care of them. You know, I clean them, and I, you know, if I need to rub some lotion on them to soften them back up if they've gotten too wet. It's not like I don't take care of my boots, because there's a huge investment when you get a handmade boot.
Any, you know, any pair of boots, yeah, especially American made, you know, a standard Lucchese, $1,000 for just the calfskin. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, yeah, the Mexican made Lettys are $600, I think.
Yeah. So, I treat them just like I treat my bridles or my saddles. You know, you got to take care of them because it's part of your everyday using gear, and doesn't matter how fancy they are, you know, I'm still going to wear them and use them, but they're going to have to last me for a really long time.
You know, it's interesting when I see a lot of people who don't take care of their boots, even a $300 pair of boots, when you can get a pair of Vans for what, $60, you know, that's a huge price. My kids, when, you know, they were in school, you know, $70 for a pair of shoes, you know, that was kind of expensive. So a $300 pair of boots, it should be taken care of because it is expensive.
It is. And there's nothing worse than blowing out a boot when you're out doing something and even if you send them in to get repaired or you have to go buy a new pair of boots, you're still going to be barefoot, you know, unless you got another pair to put on, you know. But I mean, when I was younger, you know, obviously we were hard on our boots and we didn't take care of them. We didn't appreciate, you know, what a boot was or what it cost, you know, and now I'm even if I'm wearing them every day and beating them up, I still take care of them, you know, because it's, like I said, it's like anything else. It's part of our, you know, our using gear. So we better take care of them.
Well, that kind of reminded me, you probably have a better understanding of this because you're a leather craftsman. Mm-hmm. So you work, I know you do leggings mostly, mm-hmm. but you do other leather work too. I've seen some of the things you've.
Yeah, mainly leggings or chaps. I have an appreciation for leather work. I mean, obviously my leather work isn't building a handmade boot or building a saddle, but I still build what I build a cowboy wears and uses and they rely on. And I always, you know, when I send out a pair of leggings to somebody, you know, they'll ask, well, what do I need to do? You know, and I'm like, well, you can use mink oil on them or any sort of shap wax or something to take care of them. And I said, they're obviously going to wear out faster than a lot of things just from being used, you know, in the manner of the leather, as far as what I use to buck stitch them together. But they'll still, if you take care of them, you know, they're going to last. And so I can speak from working with leather that you got to take care of leather, no matter what, you got to take care of it,
right? You
know, and treat it with some respect.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
So I've seen your leggings, they are sold in Tuskegee's, is that right? Or
well, so I do custom orders, but I also have an agreement with Tuskegee's. They want to have them hanging in their store. But they also have given me free rein to build whatever I want to build for them to hang in the store. So basically they're a customer of mine. So they, you know, if I have an idea and I want to build something off the wall, they don't question it. I build it, they buy it from me, they hang it in their store and they can sell them if they want that. You know, that's, everybody says, you know, you need to, you know, they're making money off of you. And I said, well, everybody makes money off of everybody. That's part of it. But at the same time, I was really proud that they asked me, that they wanted what I built hanging in their store, displayed for everyone to see from all over the world. I mean, and that's been a huge blessing because I've met people from different walks of life from something that I had hanging in Tuskegee's. And there's a huge, I don't need to make money off of that. There's a priceless exchange when it comes to something of mine that connects me to someone from some other walk of life, you know. And I was talking about this yesterday with someone, you know, that I met a surfer from a world-class surfer, world famous surfer from California, because I had a pair of leggings hanging in Tuskegee's last year that said "Surf's Up" on them. And he walks into him and his wife are also in the horse business, and they also have a really good they have the Surfers Healing Foundation that helps with autistic mainly autistic kids, but just building that and Tuskegee's allowing me to build something off the wall that said "Surf's Up" on it, a surfer walks into Tuskegee's and sees them, and now him and I are friends, and it's built a relationship off of that. So there's so many layers to that agreement I have with Tuskegee's, and you know, I don't need to get rich off of that. And if they make money off of it, fine, because what I've gotten back is tenfold, you know, from making a quick buck off of selling them. So I see the beauty in that. So
and you, even though you're on Emiletti's Instagram and a lot of their social media, I guess their Facebook too, mm-hmm. you're not sponsored by, or you don't have any contract with them.
No, I don't, I pay full price for my boots. They don't give me anything. Our agreement, you know, they asked, you know, it was one of those things where they liked what I did and I liked what they do. And it worked out as they put me up on their social media, and I'm proud of that. You know, I don't need to be bought in order to talk about someone's, whatever it is they make. You know, I want to be true to that. And the reason I wear their boots and the reason I do what I do with MLEDI is because I like them as people, but I also love their boots. They're not paying me anything. And I haven't asked for that, you know, I mean, they're just good people, good boots. And I think there's a lot of people out there that they want something in return. They want there to be an exchange, you know, for whatever it is they might be wearing or promoting. And sometimes it takes away from the honesty of that product. And I don't need to be bought to do that. So, and that's a touchy subject, I think, all the way around, especially now with social media and in the Western fashion, in the cowboy world. So,
sure. Absolutely. Well, we've talked about boots. Let's talk about hats, because that's a hell of a hat. Tell us about it.
So I wear an American hats. This is 100X with a 5-inch brim. And there's a lot of importance to a cowboy hat. It's individual. It's unique to each cowboy that wears it. We recognize a lot of cowboys by their hats, and I've been recognized, or my hat's been recognized before I've been recognized. And it's one of those things that, and I've written about my cowboy hats before. But once again, you know, I started wearing American hats, a few years ago. We did a photo shoot and they gave us all hats to wear, and that's the only hat they ever gave me, but it was the best hat that I've ever worn.
You're in their catalog, right?
I don't know if I'm in their cat. I've been in a couple of magazine, okay, advertisements. I don't know if I'm in their catalog. If I am,
might not be. Yeah. I'll find the picture.
But I know that there is a photograph of me from one of their ads in Cowboys and Indians and probably a couple of other publications. It's a black and white photo, actually, and that was the hat that they originally had given me. But since then, I buy my hats from them. I like everyone at the store, at Best Hat Store, and I love American hats. And it, you know, like I was saying earlier, you know, that first hat that they gave me survived a tornado. It had 6 inches of rain dumped on it when I was trying to get someone unstuck that had come to help us after the tornado. And it still held its shape. It kept its body until I finally, you know, it was time to replace it with a new one. And so that hat hangs in my leather shop, and it's a reminder of it's a reminder of a lot of things, but it's also a reminder of American hats and Best Hat Shop. You know, I admire they're great people. And once again, it's a company that's family owned. You can literally visit with the people who own American hats. And I find that to be very important with anything that we want to be involved with, is that family is involved and their quality. I mean, their hats are, I love their hats, you know, and this one's only a couple months old, and it's finally breaking in and feeling like, you know, I'm, you know, when you put on a new hat, you know, you're almost never ready to replace your old one. And so it takes a little bit of time before you get accustomed to wearing the new one. And so this one's finally, I'm starting to feel more comfortable wearing it. So.
Yeah. We talked about that off camera, that this one's, September, I think you said.
September.
And, tell a story about Danny.
Oh, so hat. when I was getting impatient about getting a new hat, I was ready for a new one, and I was just going to go buy a 40X. And they said, no, wait, we're going to wait till we get the 100X. And so then the day that I happened to be at Teske's for the weekend during their trade days. And so I drove up here one afternoon to get this hat and to have Danny shape it. And it was funny because he shaped it and had everything just right, but I put it back in the box and walked out of the store with my old hat on, because I didn't want to have the new hat on and look like a, you know, like a guy with his new cowboy hat. And so I didn't, and it took me actually, when I got back to the ranch, I would alternate with wearing my old hat and putting on this one, because I won, you know, it was just hard to break in that new hat, in the sense that I felt funny wearing a clean brand new hat. And then when I saw Danny, when we came up for Reg Degol, he couldn't believe it was the same hat. He said, that's your new hat? I said, yeah, I'd been wearing, you know, I finally started wearing it every day and working in it. You know, that's what they're for, you know? And so he couldn't believe that it was my new hat, cause it was already broke in so much, but yeah. So, and it was, he had, you know, when he shaped it, he didn't miss one part of shaping it. He just didn't realize that, you know, when I take my hat off and put it back on, is I always grab it up here on the top. And so it starts to get this little pinch right here in the top. And Danny was, man, I could have put that in the, you know, I didn't realize you put that pinch in the top. And I said, well, you know, that's not part of it. That's something that just happens over time for me, you know, taking it off and putting it back on. And it just takes on its own shape after that. So, which every hat does, you know.
It's funny because you look through your Instagram, all of your hats, they just kind of look like you work in them, and they get dirtier and dirtier. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's coming through on camera, but it's pretty dusty.
Yeah.
I mean, it, you know, I dusted this hat off before I came in here. So, it, you know,
it's one of those, it's funny because people are always like, man, you need to clean your hat. And I'm always like, I'm real hesitant. Like if they get, my other one was, I mean, it had mounds of dirt on it, you know, and I did it every once in a while. You do have to kind of wipe all that dust off of it, but I don't like to clean them so much because you kind of start getting used to the way it looks. And if I keep cleaning it, I don't necessarily feel comfortable cleaning it so much. And so, when I went back in, I think it was in January of this year, I went into Best and they asked me what color my hat originally was. And I said, it was black, you know, but it looked kind of brown, you know, and only because it had been worn so much. And they were really not convinced that it was black. And I said, and then they finally looked at it and said, yeah, it is a black hat. It's just, it changed colors between all the different dirt and dust. So
we got about 3 minutes here. Do you always wear black hats?
Yes. I used to wear a silver belly years ago. I'd wear a silver belly or a black hat, but I like the image of the black hat, and it's not good guy or bad guy. I think after watching Ranch Album 1 year, I was like, you know, the black hat just looks good on guys when they're cowboying, you know, and I like a silver belly, but I'm more comfortable wearing a black hat.
Do you wear straw in the summer or do you wear felt year round?
I wear it year round. I used to wear straws year round long time ago. And I quit wearing straw hats a few summers ago. I just wear my black hat year round and people think I'm nuts, but I'm comfortable doing it. And I do it. You're hot no matter what. So
I don't think you're nuts because I preach it. I don't particularly like straw, but yeah, sometimes it's more comfortable.
They just don't feel the same.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I grew up, you know, my old mentor used to say he never hired anybody that wore a straw hat because they spent most of their day chasing that straw hat across the pasture. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of something I always like to think about. So
there you go. You heard it here.
Yeah.
So real cowboys wear felt year round.
Yeah.
And you're down way down south too.
Well, South San Angelo, we were hot this year. We were pushing 115 degrees on some days. Yeah. But we stayed above 100 for 45 days. You know, we were 105 on average, but you just sweat, you know, you just keep working and you cool off when you can, but it makes your hat fit better when you sweat in it.
Yeah, so, it does. Yeah. It does. Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Joby's Hats was kind enough to provide some very special items for us to give away on this episode of the podcast. Head on over to the Cowboy Cartel YouTube channel and comment on the video version now. Be sure to check the video description for giveaway instructions.
So we were talking about cowboy hats and wearing felt year-round before the break. So have you not always worn American? What'd you wear before that?
I'd worn the hats I was wearing before I started wearing American were hats that Jim Spradley made out in Alpine. And that was the last felt hats I'd been wearing. And then obviously growing up, we wore Baileys and Resistalls. Whatever we could afford when we were younger yeah. is what we... is what we wore. And I can remember, I think the one hat that I wore for a long time was a Resist All hat that my dad bought me before I moved to California. And that was back in 95. And I wore that hat for a long time. And I wore it in a lot of different, I traveled quite a bit back then. So that was a Resist All hat. But the last hat before this was a Jim Spradley, and it was a good hat. It was a really good hat, but I'm convinced with American.
And the 100X, you like the 100X?
I like the 100X. I think that's, I wouldn't go anything lower than 100X, but a 100X to me is a good standard issue, American felt, in my opinion. I think it's affordable, but it's going to last you for a long time and hold its shape.
It's a huge testament to the hat that you pick 100X for working in all year long, mm-hmm. and you treat them rough. Mm-hmm. So these guys who are out there, you know, saying, well, maybe I should get a 40X or 100X. I don't know. You're not going to hurt it.
No. I've talked to guys out of getting a 40X, you know, just if you're going to, and they're like, well, it's, you know, half the price of 100X, and I'm like, yeah, but you're getting half the hat.
Exactly.
You know, and that 100X will, I mean, I can speak loud and clear about, you know, the quality of 100X lasting as a good cowboy hat that you ride, that you wear every day, you know,
holds
that you're
its
using.
Shape.
Yes, holds its shape. And it's, but I've, you know, if you're wearing handmade boots, you're riding handmade saddles, you know, you're spending a lot of money on your gear. So you might as well spend that money on your cowboy hat too, because it's the most iconic image of a cowboy is their hat. So you might as well invest in one, a good one. So.
Always the 5-inch brim?
Always. Yeah. I've tried a 4.5. I've owned, I've tried to see, you know, you almost follow the trends and you start to see people kind of go back down to a smaller brim. And I've tried to wear a 4.5 and it just doesn't feel right. You know, when I put on that 4.5, so I'll stick with the 5-inch brim.
I prefer a 4.5. This is 4.25. This is kind of just what I had when I got it. This is 40X. It's a great hat. It's one of the best 40Xs I've seen, mm-hmm. From American. I love, to me, the 500. That's my favorite hat. Just because when you are out and you meet somebody and they have not seen an American hat, you can hand them a 500X and say, this is an American hat.
Yeah.
And that's going to pique their interest and maybe they're going to go see something, because, you know, it's just, that's next level. 100X, 200X, 500X.
Yeah.
All beautiful hats.
I've been in the store. I've been in Best Hat Shop and seen guys walk in there and they go right to the 500X, and then they will preach all day long about that 500X hat, you know, the quality of it. But it is, you know, and like you say, if you hand that 500X to somebody that doesn't know much about hats, that is a great first impression of a cowboy hat.
Yeah.
And it speaks to your confidence also in that American hat. So that's a good philosophy behind having that 500X or even higher quality, you know, cowboy hat.
Sure. So. And, you know, they're rock solid too. The 500X. I mean, I don't think I've ever had to have them touched up. Like,
yeah,
2 years.
They feel amazing.
Yeah.
One day I'll have one and I'll wear it every day. So people might think I'm crazy, but
oh no,
yeah.
I think you should absolutely wear it.
Yeah.
We did a video with, we've done so many videos at Best Hat. We've done one with Ryan. we just did one with Danny. It's in editing. It's coming out really soon. We did a video with Andy, and you know, he tells a story of people wearing 1000X for ranching. So I think you should absolutely wear, you know, whatever you want.
I wouldn't hesitate to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd wear 1000X for ranching, but, I would definitely have one.
Yeah.
But yeah, what 500X people, you know, they use them hard all the time. They're not just for dress.
Yeah. And they'll last.
Yeah.
And hold their shape. That's the main thing.
Yes.
They hold their shape.
I've seen that. I've been shaping hats for about almost 2 years now. And the all rabbit hats, they don't hold their shape if they're used hard or if they're treated hard. You know, the 7X, the 10X, they're gonna be the ones that need touched up more often. So the more beaver you have in it, the better it's gonna hold that shape. Anyway, so you mentioned you mentioned your dad earlier when you went out to California. So tell us a little bit about your history. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up, we were born and raised in San Antonio. And for anybody that hasn't discovered, you know, my podcast or other podcasts that I've been on, born and raised triplets. And so I have a identical twin brother and then a fraternal twin sister. So we were the first triplets born in Bexar County in San Antonio. And we grew up in a little town called Adkins, which is just outside of San Antonio. But mom was a horse trainer. But mom and dad met because mom was a barrel racer and breakaway roper, and dad was a bull rider and bareback rider. So he was rough stock and mom was barrel racer. And so they met at a rodeo and then got married and had us. But we were... so that's where I grew up. My brother kind of followed my dad's trail a little bit into my dad quit rodeoing, obviously, when we were born, which happens to a lot of rodeo cowboys. They have to start raising a family, get real jobs. But I kind of went the way of mom with training horses, and my brother had kind of gone the way of dad and was rodeo cowboy. My brother rode bulls and bareback horses, and I tried my hand at saddle bronc riding, but I wasn't good at it. And that's the reason when I told the story in my podcast about my left arm breaking, it was riding saddle bronc horse.
I just listened to that. And it's a funny story because your mom was mad. tried to hide it.
And that was the biggest, I didn't care about breaking my arm. I cared more about disappointing my mother, you know, because she was the one that was so adamant about me not riding bucking horses. And that was kind of like the first thing that came into my head was like, oh no, you know, and I didn't want to go home. I didn't want to face her with that, but it was, you know, it was one of those things that, you know, if it hadn't happened, it would have been a lesson that I wouldn't have never learned, you know, it wouldn't have helped me become who I am. And it was because of her that I was able to do what I did when I broke my right arm, you know, last week. And that's what I had talked about in that podcast. So that was kind of growing up. That's, you know, and eventually, you know, I kind of stayed with mom in the horse training industry, and she's the one that shoved me that direction, not shoved me, but she encouraged me to stay that route with training horses. And then dad encouraged me as well, you know, to listen to mom. So that was smart on his part, was just to kind of put it all on her, you know, listen to your mother, you know, cause he wasn't a horse trainer. My dad, he liked doing everything to make mom successful in the horse business. You know, he'd either work on the barns, work on the pens, whatever needed to be done to keep her horseback and training horses. That's what dad liked. But dad would be one of the first people to tell you he didn't like horses. You know, he didn't like riding horses. He didn't like dealing with the horses, but everything that involved horses is what he liked. And so he was instrumental in keeping mom successful in the horse business with what he could do. And dad, you know, he was a good carpenter. He built houses, cabinets. He was a good all around worker, I guess is what you could say. Dad was very a physical laborer and worked with his hands, and which was, you know, I learned a lot from him as well, you know, as far as being a hard worker. So, and never complaining about work. So
how old were you when you had that accident and
when I broke my left arm?
Yeah.
So that was in 1997. So I would have been, let's see, in my late 20s, without trying to sit here and do a whole lot of math. but it was one of those things that I knew better. We were running late, getting to that rodeo. I already had a bad feeling about this rodeo. And I joked around. The friend of mine that I went with was named Kermit, and he was a bareback rider. But I joked around with him while we were driving to that rodeo that I was like, you know, I think this is going to be my last rodeo. I can't do this anymore. Cause I was trying to ride young horses. And at the time I had had a 9-to-5 job. I'd kind of explained that I wanted to spend a little bit of time doing like a 9-to-5. You know, I thought it's the easy route, you know, which it's not, you know, for what I had done my entire life up to that point, having a 9-to-5 was the worst thing I'd ever done. And, but I felt, and I didn't last long at it, but I thought, well, I can do that. I can ride horses with mom and then I can rodeo on the weekends. And I joked around about that being my last rodeo, you know, and when we got there and they already had my horse loaded in the chute. So I was hustling to get things done. And I just wasn't in that. I wasn't in the right frame of mind to get on that horse in the first place. And so I was kind of half committed to not even getting on that horse. And so when that horse came out and ran down the pin, I had already made up my mind, I'm done, you know, and I reached down and I grabbed my rein with my free hand. And right when I did that, the horse started to buck, but I was already done. And so the pickup man came in and like I had said, it wasn't anybody's fault, but I ended up that pickup horse kicked at that bucking horse. And I kind of went up in the air and I landed flat on my chest, but I hit just right to where it snapped. My left arm just right below the shoulder. So it was a high break and it was a nasty break, really bad break. So
I listened to your podcast and I heard you tell a story and I cringed when I heard it. I was like, oh man, that's awful.
Well, it was such an, you know, and I talked about like how I referred to the ghost inside my bones. And it was that where I thought my arm was in one place, but my arm was literally hanging off. Like I thought I was holding onto my belt or my belt loop with my left hand. And that's when the guy was like, no, I think you got a broken arm. And when I looked down, this lower part of my arm was just hanging off here to the side. And then all of a sudden that swelling, the swelling just grew rapidly. And then I thought, oh no. And that's when I was like, oh, I'm in deep now, you know, I knew. And even the paramedic in the ambulance, she was like, it's a pretty bad break, you know, without even seeing, she knew it was a bad break. And it turned out to be it was pretty bad.
So. Was that episode 4 on your podcast? I
think? Yes, it was episode 4.
And yeah. You just dropped episode 5, right?
I just did. That was yesterday was episode 5, but episode 4 was last week. I think it was Thanksgiving Day. I think
I saw episode 5 came out. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet. If you are interested in checking out his podcast, I will put a link in the description of both, the Spotify, Apple podcast, wherever you get your podcast, it'll be in that link. And then also, we'll throw it in the YouTube too. So go check out his podcast. It's pretty interesting. And, I think I told you this, it's kind of amazing that you can do the podcast and you're sitting there pretty much all by yourself, just talking to yourself. I have a horrible time doing that. I've tried to do those review videos before because that's what people are interested in. I can't do them because I can't sit there and just talk to myself. Yeah. So I'm impressed.
It's hard. It was something that I'm still dealing with, trying to be comfortable doing it. But what I've done, you know, obviously I prompt myself by reading the Instagram post that I'm going to talk about. That gets me going. And then I just basically have to just kind of just fade into myself, you know, just kind of shut everything out. And once I start talking, what makes it so easy for me is that what I'm talking about happened. You know, what I'm talking about, you know, whatever I wrote about happened, and I can just go back into that time. So I'm not sitting there trying to think of what to say next. I'm just going purely off of experience and memory. And then I just basically tell the story. But I also am very aware of that I want to have, there's got to be a silver lining to whatever I'm talking about, or at least some good lesson in what I'm talking about. And I find that to be really important, but it's still hard work to talk to yourself, especially when you think that, you know, there might be, you know, somebody across the other side of the planet listening to your podcast. And so, you know, I try not to think about that until I press publish, you know, then I'm like, okay, now it's out there for the whole world to listen to. But once again, it's like I said, the feedback that I'm getting from it, this makes me want to do it that much more. You know, that I feel it's not an obligation. I feel like this calling to speak to people through doing my podcast. And it's unique in the sense that I'm doing it by myself. I don't have guests. Eventually it'd be fun to have guests, but I think that would take away from what I'm actually doing with my podcast. You know, it is a very intimate podcast in the sense that I'm doing it with just myself, but I'm giving it to the world, so to speak. And so I think I want to keep it that way. Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you, I heard you say that you were still trying to find your voice mm-hmm. in your podcast. Have mm-hmm. you found that yet? Are you're five episodes in? Do you know the direction you want the podcast to go?
I know the direction I want to go with it. I the direction I'm going, I want to maintain that flow. I still think I'm finding my voice, because sometimes I question, you know, I might say, well, is this what people really want to hear? You know, because I know people want to hear, you know, stories about wild horses or bucking horses or wild cattle or some crazy experience. But I can relate all of those things together, but I'm still getting comfortable with finding my voice and sharing those, because, you know, because there's a lot of vulnerability in what I put on Instagram, but then I build upon that vulnerability when I talk for an hour about, because I'm adding more detail or more experience to whatever I wrote, because obviously your words are limited on Instagram. So I'm still getting comfortable with that, but I owe it to my audience. But my audience they're the ones encouraging me to continue. And so I feel this not an obligation, but I feel this great need to continue. Like, I don't want it to fail. I want it, you know, I have 10 episodes printed out that I want to talk about, and I'm already trying to get the next 10 lined up, because if I do it continually, like I want to try to do it once a week. Well, if I do that, then I have to keep, you know, I have to keep it going, you know, and that means continuing to share on Instagram and then building upon that with my podcast. So I'm finding my voice. It's getting there. So,
well, I still haven't found my voice, so to speak. You know, I think we're season 2, 14. So we're probably, I don't know, probably 15, 16 episodes, something like that in, maybe more. And it's changed. It's, you know, my podcast has changed from, you know, talking about all kinds of crazy stuff, whatever, you know, just whatever you can figure out, to actually having, important guests on here.
A direction.
Something to say.
Exactly.
And I've had people say, you know, you should do, a solo podcast on the days you don't have a guest. Well, that's just not me. That's not my style. I would much rather sit here and talk to somebody who has mm-hmm. something interesting to say than just to talk at a camera to talk. So my podcasts aren't regular. I would love them to be every 2 weeks, but it just doesn't fit my
schedule. And it's a lot of work. I mean, it's
a huge amount of work.
The quality for what you're putting out is a lot of work. I mean, I think what I'm doing is a lot of work, and I'm using a microphone and my iPhone, you know, to do it. And it's still a lot of work, and I'm trying to get better and better with it. But I, you know, I look at like the podcast that I like, and you see this, you know, it has its identity, you know, and then I see some podcasts that have no direction, and I lose interest in because there's no coherency or cohesiveness with what they go from one subject to another, because they don't really have a direction. But, you know, at the same time, the more I do my podcast, I feel like my direction becomes more clear. And so I feel like it'll get better and better. And I feel like the more you do a podcast, the better it gets. You learn things, and you learn more about yourself, but you also learn more about just doing a podcast. And I think there's a lot of value in podcast, either with guests or if you do it on your own. It's amazing to me, because people are like, man, you're really brave for doing a solo podcast. You're because the focus is on you. And where I think I'm pretty brave if I was to invite someone to be on a podcast, because then I would feel like I would have to make sure they're very pleased with whatever platform we're talking about. And so I feel like it's easy for me to sit there by myself in a sense and talk about what I'm talking about.
It's funny. You mentioned that because I do research. I do research. And you know, I looked into you more and I started reading more of your Instagram posts, and because I knew you were coming on here and I wanted to be able to talk about you. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to research things that you do because I didn't want it to be phony. If I learned everything there was to know about horsemanship, that would be funny because that's just not me.
Right.
But I wanted to hear it from you. You know, I wanted to hear your story about leather work, training horses, and the things that you do. So I think it's great to have. Well,
yeah, there's an authenticity to that. There's an honest curiosity and an honest seeking of knowledge or information about somebody else that maybe you're not accustomed to. And that's, you know, I think, and like I had mentioned earlier, you know, being on a podcast with someone who strictly wants to talk about film noir or writing noir short stories, you know, and I'm excited about doing that because it's something that I like, but something also that this person wants to talk to me about. It's not about training horses. They're not trying to research what I do with horses or cowboying. They want to know what inspired me to write more or to write the style that I write. So I think that there's value in all platforms when it comes to podcasts. Just because I'm a cowboy and you like wearing cowboy hats doesn't mean that you want to sit here and talk about what you know about training horses. You want to hear people's stories, but we're all connected by this umbrella of the cowboy hat and everything that the cowboy hat encompasses. So there's a great value in that.
That's a great sentence right there. I like that. So tell me about your writing. So we talked off camera a little bit about some upcoming projects. You mentioned mm-hmm. this podcast that you're going to be doing. And
writing is something that, you know, and I've spoken about it in other podcasts and then also in my Instagram. It was something even, you know, I'd mentioned my eighth grade English teacher and how we had to write a short story in class. And she made me read my short story in front of the class. And it was about a girl that was in my class. But it was the idea that I made my teacher cry from the short story that I wrote, because it was that value that, you know, all writers want to make their readers feel. They want a reaction from whoever reads their words. And so, but I never... It never occurred to me. I mean, I always liked it because my imagination was always running wild, but I never thought about the idea of writing, of being, you know, of always putting my words down on paper. And then it, you know, but because I was always reading, even when I got older and was working on different ranches and traveling, I always had books to read, but I always was very careful about keeping it somewhat hidden from everyone else I was around because I was somewhat embarrassed by reading. But I was always fascinated with the process of writing stories, either short stories for book form or screenplays for movies or concepts for movie ideas. I was always fascinated by that process. And so I started to find value in putting my words down on paper, the written word. But it became one of those things that people that read my words saw value in my words. And so the more I did that and people were like, you know, you need to write more, you know, not telling me what to do, but they were encouraging me because they saw that what I did was good. And I never thought that what I did was good. And then the more I started to write, the more I started to feel my own words. And that's, I was telling somebody, I think I was telling them, Emilio and Nate and Alina, that, you know, when I can go back and read something that I wrote and I start crying, that means it was good. You know, that I did, even if it's only, surely someone else out there would have the same reaction. And so I've really had a lot of push to keep writing. And so I've been working with somebody is writing a book on creatives in rural Texas, and they're including me in the book, but they're also encouraging me to get published. And so I'm trying to work on doing some publishing, some of my stories. And then, I'd been working on a series of children's books forever that I'm still waiting to do the illustrations. And so I've got a lot of different things that I'm working on writing wise. And I'm really focusing on a series of short stories that I started a while back. When I wrote the first one, it was, the short story is called Sunset Spelled Backwards. And it's this, I kind of fell in love with my own story when I started writing it, but I'm trying to continue writing more short stories that are connected to that short story and hopefully have enough of them that I could turn them into a book of short stories. But every short story is connected to each other within that series.
So we've got about 1 minute to a break, but real quick, what's the genre you write in?
Oof. West Texas? Yeah, West Texas genre, but all cowboy based. Okay. In a sense, ranching or cowboy based in some sense, but it's almost a noir style, kind of dark.
Okay.
Sad, so a little bit sad. So.
Well, that'll be cool. We can't wait to see that come out.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
So I'm sitting here putting the finishing touches on the new podcast, and I wanted to let you guys know about our newest giveaway. So Joby has again stepped up and hooked you guys up with some really cool and unique hat patches. I think you're going to like them. Cowboy Cartel is also going to throw in some of our new stickers. So let's take a look at what we're giving away. So Joby's given us some Stetson and Resistol keychains. We've also got some really unique Wrangler patches you don't see very often. And we're also giving Cowboy Cartel stickers. We've got the new Texas Bandit, the original OG Round Bandit, and our Black and White Bandit. So all you need to do to qualify for the giveaway is like and comment on the video. This is season 2 of the podcast, episode 4 with Jerry Gazelle. So head on over to the Cowboy Cartel YouTube channel and like and subscribe. Be sure to comment and like the video.
So we were talking about your books that may be published soon. But you have a huge collection of books yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. I love books. It's always been, it was one of those things I always joked about that, traveling and cowboying, you couldn't take all your books with you. So I was always wanting to collect books, but I couldn't because I had nowhere to keep them. Especially if I was moving every couple of years, it would be hard to take even 25 books anywhere. But I always had a fascination with books. It didn't matter if it was a cowboy book or science fiction, which I don't read a lot of science fiction, but it didn't matter the genre of book. I had some ideas of what I liked to collect. But it was one of those things, when you read one book, it leads you to another book by another author or another genre. And the more I read, the more I would go down these rabbit holes of collecting books. And so I just, once I decided I was going to collect books, I went full blown crazy on collecting books. And I think right now I've got roughly 600 books in my library, which is in my shop. But there's a connection with books that we're losing. And I don't want that to ever happen. I don't want books to not exist. There's value in the written word, but there's value in, if I have a book that I really connect with, I find a connection with the horse industry within those words. And it could be a book, I've referenced a lot about Kitchen Confidential, which was Anthony Bourdain's book.
I just saw your post on that yesterday, I think. And I love that book. I think I've read it a couple times, maybe 10 years ago is the first time I read it. Great book, it's some crazy stuff goes on.
Mind-blowing, yeah.
Yeah, some crazy stuff goes on in the kitchen.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I found value in the words that you could connect to being a horseman or the horse industry. All you have to do is change a couple of words, and Anthony Bourdain's words spoke true to the horse industry, not just the chef's life, you know, the kitchen industry, you know, cooking in restaurants. And that, and so it got to where when I would read a book, I would find those nuances that connected back to the horse industry, as long as we could relate. And so I really developed this sort of enthusiasm to read more outside of like the cowboy genre. Not that I mean, I love cowboy books, but I love, you know, I really got into reading a lot of different authors and genres just because I could find new ways to look at the horse industry through those words. And I'd go through, and now I've got all these highlighted marks in all of these different books, you know, just because I can find that connection. And I think there's great value in that. And then there's some books I just like just cause I like books. And so I'm always hunting for new books to buy and collect.
So I want to go back to you growing up and how you got into the industry. You obviously grew up in a family that had this in their blood. This mm-hmm. was, you know, this is kind of what you did, but you went and learned to train polo horses mm-hmm. at some point. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So,
because that's kind of, it's
once,
kind of,
yeah, it's once again, it's all about, you know, the universe and what it presents to us, you know, where the things that come into our lives that take us in the direction that we were meant to go. And it just happened that we grew up a couple of miles down the road from, at that time, one of the best polo players in the world and one of the best breeders of polo ponies in the world. And his name was Tommy Wayman and his dad was Billy Wayman. But they also had a little bit. Billy also trained cutting horses. And so they had this Western cowboy side to what they did, but their main focus was polo ponies. And Mom became really good friends with Billy Wayman, and they actually became partners on polo ponies. But basically, when I graduated high school, it was, you know, you're going to go to work for the Waymans. You're going to learn everything that you can about training horses. It's going to be polo horses. But there was such value in the versatility of training those polo horses. And it's just the world itself is, you know, I always talk about polo as it's global, you know, it's all over the world. And the different styles of horsemanship within the polo world, there's no one way to train a polo pony. There's lots of ways to train a polo pony. The end goal is to make a phenomenal polo pony. And so there was so much value beyond just training polo ponies. There was this world value of being in that industry. And I fell in love with it. But the connection with the cowboy or ranching world is that the wealth involved in polo allowed for these certain organizations to own ranches. So there was this great way of, you could be on a ranch and work cattle, but you were working cattle on thoroughbred horses that would eventually become polo ponies. But it was the value in getting them broke and used on a ranch that made it that much easier to train them into polo ponies. So I got the best of all of those worlds, and I got to travel quite a bit, just working in different states, working around the country with different organizations. But there was this idea, I mean, when I went to work for the Waymans, we probably had 100 horses in work. And that was 100 horses that were getting ridden every day. There was enough people there that every horse got worked. And you might not ride the same horses every day. You were riding different horses every day. So you learned how to ride those horses as individuals. And I still use that philosophy today with every horse that I train. No, not because none of my horses are the same, so I can't train them the same. So you find ways to adjust. But I've also had to learn, you know, going in the horse show world, how to learn new ways of training horses. I can't use what I learned in the polo industry to train, you know, a reined cow horse or to train a roping horse. I mean, you can add some elements to it, but not all of the elements of a polo pony. So I wouldn't trade any of that for the world. I mean, and people are always really curious about the polo world. And I always say, I can't put into words what the polo world is. It's a phenomenal horse industry. and phenomenal horsemen, phenomenal athletes, and what they can do with a horse and what they can do running 35 miles an hour down a 9-acre grass field and hit a 3.5 hit a little ball that's the size of a salt, you know, smaller, like the size of a hard ball, you know, off a horse, you know, and it's addicting. And it's something that once you've experienced it, you'll never lose that feeling of being in the polo world, even if I'm not in it anymore. I mean, I still dabble with it a little bit, but I'll never give up that polo world as far as horses go. I owe a lot to that industry for where I am today. So, and I just happened to grow up down the road from it, you know, so that was, it all worked out. So.
So what's next for you? I know Miss Jones is on vacation. What's next for you the rest of the year?
And so I'll get my other horses back up. I'm kind of short on horses right now, which I'm fine with. Miss Jones is going to get, she'll get the rest of the year off, and then I'll get her back up in January and start training on her some more. I've got a 2-year-old, coming 3-year-old gelding that I bought from the King Ranch, and he's got a pretty good start. And so I'm going to focus on him, and get him, try to catch up on him and start showing him this next year. And then I've got a yearling coming 2-year-old stud horse that I raised, I'm not sure which direction to go with him yet. He's bred to be a speed horse. But I'll start him, probably in the spring. And then I'm really going to focus on Miss Jones and see how far I can take her this coming year. I like to set goals, but I also like to be very, very aware that they're horses, you know, they can get injured. They could all of a sudden decide they don't want to be a show horse anymore. So my goals are, you know, I'd like to do well at the finals in May, the RHAA finals in Abilene. My goal is to at least get to the semifinals. And then, you know, if I can get to the semifinals, then I would like to get to the finals, but I would like to set that goal at least to get to the semifinals with Miss Jones, in May. And then from there, figure out where to go next. And just keep, you know, the podcast, I really want to push the podcast, and then keep writing and then hopefully get some things published. But I'm trying to get more involved and get off the ranch more, I guess, if that makes any sense, like what I'm doing right now. You know, I want to get more involved with the public, and working on some different projects, and hopefully, you know, things will take off where I don't have to, where I can start to rely more on myself than rely on the ranch that I work for and take care of. So
we wish you the best of luck with all of that. Tell us where you can find your podcast. Is it just on Spotify?
Well, it's on Spotify right now. I'm having to figure out a different way to get it, because I have to come out with a different, because I do it through Spotify, but apparently I'll have to do it through a different app. So that app will supply it to all other platforms like Apple or Google. But right now, since I do it through Anchor, it won't allow me to put it on different platforms or networks, I guess. And so eventually I'd like to get it where it's available everywhere, but right now it's available on Spotify. And you don't have to pay for Spotify to listen to the podcast. Somebody had made the comment the other day that they don't pay for Spotify, that they wish they could listen to it for free, but you can. You can go on Spotify and find my podcast, and you can listen to it without being, you know, you can have just the, I mean, obviously there's advertising when you don't pay for Spotify, but you don't have to pay to listen to it. And the podcast is called, There Is Always Something to Chase, or you can just put my name in and it'll take you to my podcast and to other podcasts that I've been on as well.
We will put your links, what we can. If we can get Spotify link, we'll put the link in the description. We'll also put a link to your TikTok so people can check that out. Instagram, and you don't have any other social media, I don't think, right?
No, that's it. No, right. Facebook.
Well, yeah. All right, we'll put all the links below that we can. And if you need help with when you decide you want to go global with your podcast, I got it figured out.
Yeah.
So yeah. I can hook you up with some programs that'll let you get all that going. And I really appreciate you coming out and talking to us.
Yeah.
It's been a real blast. And I would love to come down and do some more work with you.
Absolutely. Everybody's welcome to the ranch. And I mean, I appreciate you having me on. I think the appreciation for everything that's come in just the last year, it's mind blowing to see that people are curious about what I have to say, but that they're willing to take the time, you know, to do something like this and put all that work into it. So I appreciate it more than I could express. So thank you.
No problem. We really do appreciate it. All right. So that's going to wrap it up for today. We really appreciate American Hat Company and Joby's Hat for the continued support of the channel. As always, American Hat is my brand of choice. And if I'm going to have my hat shaped, Joby's Hats. So check them out. Thanks.